George Bernard Shaw called her the greatest living Irishwoman, and William Butler Yeats said she was my sole advisor for the greater part of my life. Author, folklorist, landlady, and theater manager, Lady Augusta Gregory played a central role in the development of modern Ireland. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. My guest today for a show on the fabulous Lady Gregory and the Irish Revival is Kevin Riley, President Emeritus of the University of Wisconsin System and Scholar of Irish Literature. Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you, Emily. Very nice to be back with you.
So why Lady Augusta Gregory? She's not a household word. What made you interested in her?
Well, she's not, and that in a way is part of her genius, I guess. She was a woman who was at the center of the Irish literary and cultural revival at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, and William Butler Yeats, who you mentioned was her star pupil, if you want to think of him that way, or mentee. So she managed to concatenate all of these male Irish writers and move them forward into prominence in a world, finally, literature by virtue of her remarkable set of talents and characteristics. So you mentioned a few of them. She was a playwright in her own right, and she wrote a number of plays for the Abbey Theatre, which is still running in Dublin and which she helped to found and then was a director of. So she was really the head director and the business person who kept it alive. And many of her plays really were written, they're kind of light comedies, were written to help keep the Abbey alive when it was struggling financially. So she melded her artistic sensibility and her very strong business talents. She was also a large estate owner in Galway in Western Ireland. She was married to a very wealthy fellow, a knight, in fact, Sir William Gregory, who was the governor of Ceylon at one point in his career, a member of Parliament. This was an old English family that had come over at the time of Cromwell into Ireland. And he was 36 years older than she. He died when she was 39. And at age 39, she was a young widow who had to take over the management of this huge estate with all the labor issues with the Irish tenants who work there. And she managed to do that very, very efficiently. She was a constant writer. She was a memoirist, a letter writer, a diarist, an autobiographer. She wrote an autobiography of her husband, who I mentioned. She wrote an autobiography of her nephew, Hugh Lane. So she was always at that, and she lived a long life. She lived 80 years, born in 1852, died in 1932. And if you think of those years in the evolution of Western society, really, these were the years when the modern era was coming on. So she was born into a very Victorian era and died in 1932 after the First World War in what was then a thoroughly modern era. And part of what's interesting, I think, about her is that she's Anglo-Irish, right? What does that mean? Well, her family was English, came over to Ireland, and as part of the effort by the British Crown to colonize Ireland, in effect, by giving land to wealthy families. But over the centuries, they became Irish, more Irish than the Irish, as the phrase goes. And so she's one of those people with a kind of dual mentality, and that tension about, you know, how Irish am I, how English am I, was something that really propelled her interest in literature and in the future, helping to define the future of Ireland. So, and her estate, Coole Park, is now a domain of the of a park in Ireland, a preserve where people can go and visit. So she's present even in Ireland physically in a landholding way, if you want to think of it that, at the Coole Park estate. So this is a woman who just had lots of different angles to her, who's fascinating, and I found it. I thought, well, you know, she deserves a little more credit than she's gotten, and we can talk about why that is.
It seems there's a lot of women from the 19th century, early 20th century, who don't get the credit they deserve. They, you know, are doing a lot of work behind the scenes or even ghostwriting and helping other men get the fame that they have. But I know we'll get to it, but Yeats does mention her in his Nobel Prize speech as one of the people that he's indebted to her, though I think he also insults her as, at that point, too, as an old woman with infirmities or something.
Right,
but before we get to her marriage to to Major Gregory, 36 years older, and I understand that she kind of fell in love with his library.
yeah, more than him, perhaps.
But before we get there, let's get her born. Tell me more about the family that she was born into, and were they then sort of anti-Irish? Were they British in the sense of kind of looking down on the Irish peasantry, the Irish language, Irish cultures? What kind of background did she come from?
Yes. This was very much the background she came from that you just characterized, and this was part of how her Anglo-Irish identity started but then evolved over the course of her long life. So her family were the Persses, P-E-R-S-S-E, old English family who had a huge estate called Roxborough, which was not that far away from Coole Park, which she would go to when she married Sir William Gregory. And they were very conservative, pro-British, Tory family. Her mother was a Protestant proselytizer, interested in converting Irish Catholics, and she would, the mother would haul her older daughters, including Lady Gregory at some points, Augusta as she was known then, with her in these sessions to try to convert the Catholics to Protestantism. So she was the 12th of 16 children. Her father had a previous wife, and then the second wife was her mother. She was thought to be not very attractive, and her mother kind of made that clear to her and preferred her older sisters, who were thought to be more attractive. And her mother also preferred the boys, who were kind of rapscallions. Several of them wound up being alcoholics. But they were a rich English sort of cavalier family, and that's how she grew up. And she was always quiet, sort of prim, a reader. You mentioned the books in her husband-to-be's library. So she started there and would evolve by the time of the 1916 uprising into somebody who really, if not fully supportive of that uprising, was sympathetic to it. And a number of the actors in the Abbey Theatre who she was overseeing were part of that uprising. And one of them actually was killed, and she has some very moving words to say about him. She really liked him. So this was a person, talk about being caught over the course of a long life between two radically different worlds. And those Protestant families who owned the big estates had huge houses. They called them the big houses. And one of the things that happened in her lifetime was that more and more of those families were being displaced throughout the course of the Anglo-Irish War in 21-22, and then the Irish Civil War, which followed right on it. A number of the houses burned by IRA or other factions. And they never did burn her house at Coole Park because they appreciated what she had done for the revival of Irish culture. And they made a point of saying that publicly. Her family's house, back to where she started, Roxborough, was burned during the Civil War.
Burned as protest against the sort of English upper-class, colonial-like kind of takeover of land?
Exactly. And the colonial word, I think, is crucial in understanding her. You know, this Ireland, in a way, was a third world country at the beginning of the 20th century, and it was the first to really stage what became a successful full-scale rebellion against the British Empire. And as in subsequent efforts like that, where the British Empire was slowly taken apart, part of the effort by the rebels was to look back at their own culture inheritance and say, this is valuable to us. We see beauty, we see character in the writing, in the songs and the fables, the folk stories that we're told, and we're going to bring them into the modern world and cling to them as part of our identity, distinct from the English identity, which has been imposed on us. So in the course of the 20th century, many former colonies went through that same kind of transition. Ireland was one of the early ones, and she was kind of in the middle of thinking through how to do that. Now, if you said to her when she started her work collecting folk stories on the Aran Islands, that's where she was going to wind up, I think she would have said, well, I'm not going there.
But she probably would have encountered the Gaelic language, Irish folklore and myth from maybe the servants that worked on her estate.
She did.
As a child?
There was one woman who was a maidservant by the name of Mary Sheridan, to whom she was very attached. Again, she had a cool relationship with her mother. Father was very, very distant. So Mary Sheridan was a sort of substitute parent for her. And she spoke Irish, and she was a great fan of the 1798 Irish Rebellion, which she kept telling Augusta about. So Augusta later in life would speak of her glowingly. You know, there's some debate among the scholars about, well, how much of that did she exaggerate? Because by then she wanted to have some identification with the Irish nationalist cause, with the language. She did study Irish and learn it. She's had a few false starts, but she did get fairly proficient at it eventually. So she was one of the few of the English writers in the Anglo-Irish revival to do that. And so she was, in that sense, again, somebody who early on was brought into this other world of Irish Catholic nationalism through people who worked on the estate that she liked.
Now, when she married Sir Gregory, she was marrying into a pretty conservative family there, but very wealthy and titled?
Yes. William Gregory's family goes way back, as I said, to the time of Cromwell in Ireland, and several of his forefathers had been British officials in Ireland, governors of one kind or another. So they had a very long history of presiding over Ireland. And it's interesting, the family always wanted to believe that they had this very positive relationship with their tenants. And as the land wars started up to dispossess a lot of these folks from the land that the British government had given them, Sir William Gregory was always very hurt by this. He didn't really believe that they didn't like him somehow. Not probably an unheard of attitude mm-hmm. and for people who have a certain level of privilege in whatever country they're in. But there's a great story about how he was heartbroken when one day he was walking around in his estate and the men he passed failed to tip their hats to him, and he knew the world had changed.
I saw a caricature that was done of him, not very attractive. So
no.
So she marries this man 36 years older than she is, gets access to an estate and an incredible library. Was she a devoted wife or not so much?
Well, you mentioned the caricatures of him, and they are funny, as caricatures are. And this is a guy who had two of the wildest mutton chops that you would ever see on a man's face. So, you know, she always spoke kindly of him. I think she liked him. But love might be too strong a word to use. She did have an affair early on with a minor English poet and Irish activist, Wilfred Scawen Blunt, who was quite a scalawag. He had affairs with very many women in the Victorian era. And that was when she was newly married. One of the things that the marriage with Sir William Gregory allowed her to do was to travel. So he was a big international traveler. As I mentioned, governor of Ceylon at one point. He was married to his first wife at that point, so she was not there, Augusta. But they traveled a lot in the Middle East, and at one point in their travels to Egypt, they became enamored of one of the Egyptian rebels who was trying to free Egypt from English domination. So that was kind of one of an early experience with this anti-colonial thing that shaped her thinking. And she wouldn't really have been able to do that if she hadn't been married to somebody like Sir William Gregory, who, again, was an internationalist, a government figure who traveled the world on behalf of England and liked to travel. So I wouldn't say it was a loving marriage in that sense, but one that was not unhappy and was very useful to her. And I think when he died and she was 39, she decided she was not going to marry again, and she never did. And she decided, well, I'm going to take my place in the world now, building on what I've inherited from him, both in terms of the wealth, but also in terms of the internationalist and intellectual perspective that he had. You mentioned this very elaborate library that he had, which she fell in love with, perhaps more than him.
And the son from this marriage, and he thought that it wasn't actually Sir Gregory's child, or
there were rumors that her son Robert was actually the son of a blacksmith, an Irish blacksmith who worked on the estate and who, shortly after Robert was born, went off to America and was never heard from again. I think, again, the scholars would say the rumors were there, but there's not enough supporting evidence to say that was definitely true.
And tell us about him and the, you know, the tragic life he had.
Yeah. So Robert Gregory was an interesting character, a young man, again, aristocrat growing up on this fancy estate, a very good athlete. He was a good artist, a painter. He did wind up actually doing some terrific theater scenery painting for the Abbey Theater for his mother and Yeats. He married another aristocratic person, Margaret, who became his wife, and they had three children. But he always felt, maybe we would call it imposter syndrome now. He always felt a bit like an imposter, like he was good at a lot of things, but master of none. He also had an affair, and there was somewhat of an estrangement between himself and his wife, and he decided he was going to volunteer and go into the Royal Flying Corps in World War I, was assigned to Italy, and was killed in a plane crash. At first, they thought he had been shot down, but later thought it was a shoot down, it was a friendly fire shoot down. There's still some confusion about how he actually died. But this was a crushing blow to her. And interestingly, he was always probably more loyal to the crown than she became, at least later in her life. But he was also caught in that Anglo-Irish tension. So in one of Yeats's poems about him, there's a great couplet where he is, the poem is, an Irish airman foresees his death. And he's thinking in his voice in the poem that those that I fight, I do not hate. Those that I guard, I do not love.
So he's fighting against people that he isn't particularly against, and defending people who he's not particularly from. That seems like a limbo land politically.
Exactly. And I think that's kind of where he felt he was. His feeling toward Ireland was compounded by the fact that his wife was actually involved in an ambush by the IRA, and she was the sole survivor of that ambush. So you can imagine the tensions where you're living in very close proximity. You're a minority, but a very wealthy minority in this country where there's growing desire to get you and your family out. And one of the ways he escaped all that was to go and be evidently a very accomplished flyer and fighter pilot who really enjoyed that. But he died then at age 37. Was buried in Padua in Italy. His body was never brought back, and she never, his mother never went there and visited his grave.
You mentioned that Lady Gregory wrote a lot. What did she have to say about her son's death?
I'll read one thing she said in her autobiography about it. But she also egged Yeats on relentlessly to write about Robert because she wanted the poetic, the kind of powerful poetic memory of him installed in Western literature, which it has become mm-hmm. through poems like An Irish Airman Foresees His Death and others. But so this is a little story that she tells about having gotten the word that he had died, and she is at that point either in Dublin or at Coole, but she has to go to tell her daughter-in-law, who's at one of her sister's houses, that this has happened. The daughter-in-law, Robert's husband, does not know.
Can you say Robert's wife? Say the daughter-in-law, Robert's wife. You said husband.
The daughter-in-law, Robert's wife, does not know about it. So she's going down to tell him. Or tell her, and let me just grab that quotation and read it. It's very, very touching. So she's going on a train, and she says, as the train went on, a few tears came. The stranger, an Englishwoman, made tea for herself and got out her lunch basket and offered me some. I could but shake my head. I wondered she did not know she was near so much grief. I changed into the Galway train. Daily, the porter we knew was not there, or he would have known. I was glad there was no one who guessed. In the train, I felt it was cruel to be going so quickly to break Margaret's heart. I wished the train could go slower. I took a car at Galway and drove to the house, giving the man his fare. A maid opened the door. It was agony knowing the journey was at an end. I asked if Mrs. Gregory, that is, her daughter-in-law, was in. And the maid said, yes, she's in the study with the mistress, Augusta's sister. I went to her room and told the maid to send her to me there. I stood there and Margaret came in. She cried at once, is he dead? Then I sat down on the floor and cried. Mm. Very touching. I like particularly that sense of the Englishwoman making tea in the train. Doesn't know she's near so much grief. I thought it's a very touching way to talk about your own grief.
And the way she describes wishing the train could go more slowly because she knows she's delivering such bad news. Yes. We're going to hear a response from Yeats to the death of Robert Gregory when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Some 19 German planes, they say, you had brought down before you died. We called it a good death. Today can ghost or man be satisfied? Although your last exciting year outweighed all the others, you said, though battle joy may be so dear, a memory even to the dead, it chases other thought away. Yet rise from your Italian tomb, flit to Kiltartan Cross, and stay till certain second thoughts have come upon the cause you served, that we imagined such a fine affair. Half-drunk or whole-mad soldiery are murdering your tenants there. Men that revere your father yet are shot at on the open plain. Where may new-married women sit and suckle children now? Armed men may murder them in passing by, nor law nor parliament take heed. Then close your ears with dust and lie among the other cheated dead.
That's a poem by Yeats dedicated to Major Robert Gregory. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Kevin Riley, and we are talking about Lady Augusta Gregory, a fabulous and remarkable woman, in this case, who lost her only child, Robert Gregory, and asked her friend Yeats to write poems about it. Tell us about the growing relationship that Lady Gregory had with Yeats and other Irish writers and her whole impetus in terms of starting the Irish National Theater.
Mm-hmm. Well, she decided early on that she was going to go out to the Aran Islands and listen to what people were talking about there. This was the most remote part of Ireland, many Irish speakers there, and this was a place where the old stories and songs were still alive, as it were. So she did that. She took Yeats out there with her, John Millington Synge, a playwright who became part of the Irish literary revival, also spent a lot of time there, and that kind of became the impetus for them to think about what could we do in literature that would capture the old Irish culture and bring it in an interesting way to the what was becoming the modern world. They felt that the theater, especially, would be able to capture the sound of the language, the cadence of the language. And that was, I think, why the theater became of interest to them as a vehicle for developing Irish culture in the way they did. It also let them, after a bit of a false start where they were using mostly English actors and actresses, bring in the native Irish actors and actresses, cultivate a whole new generation of them that spoke with, obviously, an Irish accent that made the whole thing seem more real to the audiences that would come. And so they were able then to attract audiences in Ireland to this new form of theater, which really was an old form brought forward into the modern world and crafted by talented modern playwrights, Lady Gregory herself, Yeats, Synge, and others.
But if she's starting a theater that's going to do Irish plays with Irish actors, then wouldn't she have lost the kind of more British audience, Anglo-Irish audience that would expect to go to the theater and hear Shakespeare?
Yes, and I think she was willing to sacrifice that audience. I think she saw her audience as this new group of theater goers, of native Irish speakers who wanted to be proud of their intellectual and cultural heritage. She also took the Abbey Theater Company on two tours of the United States, and she loved being in the United States. But there, of course, the main audience was Irish Americans or Irish immigrants to America. So she was dealing with that population both in America and in Ireland. And especially when they were performing Synge's Playboy of the Western World, there were some of that Irish population theater goers who didn't like it. They had riots, actually, at performances of that play in Dublin and in Philadelphia, where in Philadelphia, the entire troupe of the Irish actors at the Abbey Theater, from the Abbey Theater, were arrested.
Now, they were arrested for sort of indecency or, because the plays had lower class characters, prostitutes? What was it that led to an arrest of a company of actors?
Well, there was a statute that in Philadelphia that prohibited immodest or immoral plays, and they were arrested under that statute. The particular trigger in Playboy of the Western World was the use of the word shift, which meant a woman's slip, and that set the rioters off. That was the cue for them to start shouting and throwing stuff at the stage. And Lady Gregory, in that instance, got the admiration of a lot of the younger Irish actors and actors by standing up very firmly against it. And she got John Quinn, a lawyer from New York, to come down and defend them in court. They got the charge thrown out, and they went on and kept doing the play. And she was adamant that they were going to keep doing this play.
But she never got arrested herself?
She never got arrested herself, and she said she really did not want to, because if she did, she'd look like a suffragette.
Well, that's interesting. If she sort of did not want to be like a suffragette, yet in so many ways she was kind of a proto-feminist. She was doing things that women often didn't and taking a leadership role, but she didn't want to be linked to women wanting the vote.
That's right. And that's one of the inherent contradictions in her personality. She still retained that sense of a Victorian lady while she was pushing the boundaries of what women could do in the business and artistic and political world, even.
I heard that there were potatoes and tomatoes thrown on the stage.
There were. That's right. Yes, there were all sorts of objects, and put you in mind now when you hear about some of our singers complaining about cell phones being thrown at them on the stage.
So she went on these tours to America. What did she think? I mean, is it true that she kind of crossed paths with a couple of presidents or heard from some?
She did. So Teddy Roosevelt, interestingly, was a fan, and she invited him to come and attend, and he did, at least on one night, went backstage and greeted all of the actors and actresses and pulled her forward at the end of the play and had a round of applause given to her. So he was very supportive. He asked her at one point in the course of the conversation whether she was a Catholic, and she said, "Oh, no, it's only the Protestants who do anything."
So
another contradiction.
Yeah, so she's celebrating Irish culture. She's traveling with Irish actors, but she still feels that Protestants are superior, much like her mother before her, who was kind of a Protestant proselytizer.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. And that sense of sort of prim superiority never entirely left her. It was too ingrained in the world that she'd grown up in. So again, what makes her interesting as a person and as a cultural icon is that tension, and it's partly the Anglo-Irish tension in that particular context. And I was thinking, you know, we have now with the debate over Brexit and the Northern Ireland border with now that England is no longer part of the European Union. What's going to happen with that border? Is Northern Ireland Irish or is it English? That debate goes on, and that's the debate that sort of propelled her life, and she always stood on both sides of that question in some way.
Are there any accounts of her as the sort of the founder and manager of the Abbey Theater or other theaters that would give us a sense of her personality? Let's say she took to the stage to kind of push back against the audience that's about to riot or is speaking. Do we know anything about what kind of a personality she had, her voice, her, you know, how she dressed, anything that you know, obviously we don't have video, but what is known about her?
Let me read a little bit from an account by one of the young Irish actresses that she was a mentor for, really, Mair Nahooly. She first met her when Nahooly was very young, probably 18, she kind of looked to Nahooly like this was this old lady from Western Ireland who was coming into Dublin to boss around the young Irish actors and actresses. So here's how she describes her. This is Marie Nahooly describing Augusta Gregory. "She often had her own way as far as the affairs of the Irish National Society were concerned, for although she was not altogether overbearing, she was tenacious, which is much the same thing. I have many memories of her during these years, presiding maternally at one of those suppers she loved to hold in the theater on first nights, or in different circumstances, drawing up her short, rather bulky figure, squaring her shoulders, and smiling grimly in a thin-lipped manner in face of opposition. Or again in later years, bustling with her strange strutting walk through the abbey, meeting distinguished visitors in the vestibule before the curtain rose on new plays, smiling her fixed social smile, or talking rapidly in her odd, flat-toned way. Her interest in the theater was profound, and with the years it quickened. When in 1910 she assumed part control of the abbey, the theater became a life interest, as she wrote herself, one of her, quote, enthusiasms. She was the Abbey's self-appointed champion, and it is doubtless that but for her perseverance, the theater might have closed its doors during the lean years after its establishment as an independent concern, its control vested in a directorate. With Yeats, she fought all its battles and surmounted all its difficulties." So that's quite a tribute by this young Catholic mm-hmm. Irish actress who was very skeptical about Lady Gregory when they first met.
Is it true that the lawyer, Quinn, that helped with the case that had been brought when they were on tour that landed the whole troupe in jail, is it true she then had an affair with him?
It is, and that's interesting. So she was married to this much older man, became a widow at 39 when Sir William Gregory died, had this affair early on in their marriage with Wilfred Scallon Blunt, and then later fell in love in brief affair with a man who was 18 years her junior, John Quinn, who is a wealthy Irish lawyer, Irish-American lawyer in New York, who who was really important in helping to sustain some of the artists in the Irish literary renaissance by giving them direct subsidies, by working with them on their legal rights to their works. And I mentioned already he actually went down to defend the Abbey Theatre troupe in court in Philadelphia. So she fell very much in love with him. He was a guy who was playing the field, and he was interested in her, but it didn't last. But they remained friends because he was so useful to her, and she was useful to him in his connection to the Irish world. There's a funny quick story about Quinn when he did go down to defend the Abbey Theatre Players in Philadelphia. He was cross-examining a witness for the prosecution who was claiming this was a dirty play and they shouldn't have put it on. And at one point, this fellow on the stand, when he was objecting to what had happened, said, "Well, the stage is no place for a sense of humor." So Quinn liked to quote that in later years.
That would kind of take care of comedies then.
I guess it would.
Anything else about Lady Gregory and those years after her husband's death, when she is championing the theater, when she is meeting others, and when she is trying to turn Cool Park, her estate, into a place that writers can be nurtured?
Yes. That place of Cool Park is really important in this story, I think. Yeats went down there for something like 19 summers, wrote some of his best poetry in one of the upper rooms, and she'd stop people from bothering him and send him up food periodically. He got to walk the grounds and get inspired by them. His Wild Swans at Cool poem, a pretty famous one, was written about the swans in the lake there at Cool Park. And there's a famous tree still on the grounds in Cool Park you can visit that has the initials of many of the great writers in the Irish literary renaissance carved into it. Yeats, Synge, Sean O'Casey, who she became friends with later on in life. He was much younger. So you can see a very tangible remnant of what she did at Cool Park there. And
someone pointed out in an article that tree where you have all the initials of the famous male writers, but it doesn't have her initials, that's kind of emblematic of this woman who's behind the scenes. She's helping to bring out these gifted Irish writers, but never fully present.
Yeah, that's right. So when her husband died, she then was tending to Cool Park for her son. Women couldn't own property. She didn't own the place when her husband died. Her son, who was then very young, did. And when he was killed in the war, World War I, then his wife and really their male son, her grandson, Richard Gregory, really was the owner in waiting. So she served as a kind of regent, and she saw herself as that is, she was taking care of it, stewarding it for the next generation of males in the family.
What did she think of Queen Victoria? Because, you know, she would have been born into this era where you have a queen presiding at a time when women in many ways didn't have much power or rights. But that's a contradiction,
that's
too.
That's right. I think she admired the queen, and I think my senses drew some sense of strength from watching her operate. They were not close friends, but she was certainly an icon who presided over an age. And ironically, Lady Gregory exercising more sort of authority, power, her own talents than most women could or were able to, would help to overthrow that Victorian empire and sensibility that this other very strong woman really put together, created in so many ways through the course of her very long rule. So that's another one of the sort of ironies in Lady Gregory's life. Her attitude toward British royalty got less and less friendly, I would say, as time went on.
More on Lady Augusta Gregory, and we'll hear some of her writing when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. Last year, I saw a wild duck come out of a clump of bamboo and walk with dignity up the green slope, followed by her 7 little ones. I hoped she would be able to lead these to safety, but a day or two later, I found one of the tiny creatures lying dead near the gate into the woods. Pheasants used to make their nests in sheltered corners or under a great sheaf of pampas grass, but of late, since the division of lands outside the walls, they are tempted from the fruit and seeds of woods and garden, and thieving in the oats and barley of the small tilled fields meet their end. I hope as easily as when in winter time the beater's cries in the woods would send them rocketing high over these walls. Son, husband, brothers were all fine shots, and many a man might have envied their sudden soaring death. And as I sit here in the winter time or rough autumn weather, I sometimes hear the call of wild geese and see them flying high in the air towards the sea. I have gone far out in the world, east and west in my time, and so the peace within these enclosing walls is fitting for the evening of my days. That's from Cool by Lady Gregory. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Kevin Riley, and we are talking about the fabulous Lady Augusta Gregory and the Irish Revival. Tell us about Cool.
Well, yes, it became this centerpiece of the Irish literary revival because, as we mentioned earlier, Yeats spent a lot of time there, but she invited all of these Irish writers down. They all came. It was a kind of Irish salon, if we want to put two words together that often don't get put together, for literary artists of her time. And then she was keeping it for her son and her grandson and wanted to pass it on to the future of Ireland as a sort of symbol of what she and the others in the revival had done. And as I mentioned earlier, it is now open to the public, Irish and visiting people visiting Ireland to see it. The house was knocked down, sadly, by an Irish developer. So you can't see the house, but you can walk the grounds if you're visiting.
And why did she publish something called Cool?
Well, she wanted a history of the place from her point of view, I think. Again, she couldn't own it in a legal sense, but she wanted to own it in an intellectual and emotional sense. And there's another book about Cool that one of her granddaughters, Anne Gregory, wrote called Me and New, N-U, and New is her sister. And it's a wonderful book about their spending their time with their grandmother at Cool Park, and that's become sort of part of the mythology of the place. There's also a great story that Anne Gregory tells in there about her grandmother when they were in the Standard Hotel in Dublin and having tea, and toward the end of it, her grandmother took an envelope out of her purse, took the sugar bowl and poured the sugar into the envelope and sealed it and put it back in her purse. And the young granddaughters are saying, "Man, Grandma, what are you doing?" She said, "Well, I paid for this sugar, so I don't want to leave it for these other people to use it." And they were, of course, horrified by this behavior, by their wealthy aristocratic grandmother poaching the sugar.
I noticed in the writing from Cool, there's a wistful and poetic sound to it as she's describing nature, but also as she's describing the evening of her own days. What did she think of the sort of modernist Irish writers coming along, like James Joyce, for instance?
Well, she had a touchy relationship with Joyce, and he made sort of unsparing fun of her in Finnegan's Wake, especially. He was not much for the Irish revival generally. He was somebody who wanted very much to look forward. He wanted to understand the past, but to look forward and create radically new forms of art, which he did. And he referred to the Celtic twilight, which was often a label given to this effort to bring back into full light the old Irish stories and language. He referred to it as the Celtic toilet, T-W-A-L-I-T, which of course is a pun on toilet. Mm-hmm. She didn't much like him finally either. So in a letter to Yeats in 1920, she said this about James Joyce. "Joyce's writing is a revelation of that obscenity, the mind of the Dublin cad. In the old days, I knew there were such people, but never met them and never thought about them, and it was so with us all. We ignored these creatures. Now Joyce has dragged them into the light, and it had to be done, for they are powerful in making themselves felt. It was, of course, they that denounced the theater and sing. Perhaps they will rejoice and be cured by horror and self-disgust.
So not a ringing endorsement
not
for James Joyce.
No.
Was Lady Gregory alive when Yeats got the Nobel Prize for Literature?
Yes, she was old, ailing, but he made a point in his Nobel lecture to talk about her contribution. Here's what he said. "It was not, however, until I met in 1896 Lady Gregory, a member of an old Galway family who had spent her life between two Galway houses, the house where she was born and the house into which she married, that such a theater became possible. All about her lived a peasantry who told stories in a form of English which has much of its syntax from Gaelic, much of its vocabulary from Tudor English. But it was very slowly that we discovered in that speech of theirs our most powerful dramatic instrument, not indeed until she began to write. Though my plays were written without dialect and in English blank verse, I think she was attracted to our movement because their subject matter differed but little from the subject matter of the country stories."
So he's giving his Nobel Prize lecture, his acceptance, and he is really saying that Lady Augusta Gregory helped him find that language, the vernacular, the Irish past that he then wove into his literature.
Absolutely. So it was very nice that at that late date, at least, he did give her that kind of public acknowledgement. There's lots of evidence, for instance, that she was a big part of writing his poem or his play Kathleen O'Houlihan, which she never got any credit for, and she didn't seek it. She wrote in a number of entries in her diaries and elsewhere that she recognized early on that Yeats was brilliant, difficult, but she wanted to give him the opportunity to develop what she saw early on and believed in was his genius. And she stuck to that agenda selflessly through her whole life.
Do you think that if there had been no Lady Augusta Gregory, you would have the same William Butler Yeats and the poems that he ended up writing?
No, not at all. And he said as much. I mean, she was so crucial to him. When he first started to go down to Cool, he was bereft because his love affair with Maud Gonne, his long lover, had broken up. He was poor. He was almost homeless in a way. He liked to think of himself as a sort of aristocrat, but he came from a fairly modest middle-class family, and he was ill, and she really kind of nurtured him back into physical and intellectual health. And part of that was taking him out to the Aran Islands and getting him involved in thinking about the language and the literature which could grow out of that that native Irish experience.
Is there a Yeats poem that when you read it, you sort of feel Lady Gregory's presence in it, or think this is sort of the culmination of the work that she did to bring up to elevate Irish writing and bring it out to the world?
There is. It's one of my favorites by Yeats. It's The Lake Isle of Innisfree, and ironically, perhaps, this Lake Isle of Innisfree is in Loch Gill in Sligo, where Yeats was raised. It's not at Cool Park, but there is a lake at Cool Park, and he spent a lot of time imbibing the atmosphere around that. We already mentioned his writing about the swans there. But this is a great poem by Yeats that is evocative of the whole kind of world that Cool Park gave him. "I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honeybee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the veils of the morning to where the cricket sings. There midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always, night and day, I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. While I stand on the roadway or on the pavement's gray, I hear it in the deep heart's core."
That is so beautiful.
It is.
We opened this hour with some music that you had chosen, Foggy Dew. Can you tell me something about this particular performance, performer, the song, and why that seemed like a good musical choice for something about Lady Augusta Gregory?
So the Foggy Dew is an old Irish, it's based on a very old melody. It was a revolutionary ballad about the 1916 uprising in Dublin. Talks about the British sailing their gunships up the Liffey to bombard the rebel positions in Dublin with their big gunships, and they're sailing out of the Foggy Dew on the Liffey. And there's just a beautiful rendering of it that we have as part of this show by Sinead O'Connor, who recently died, the Irish singer. And I thought it was kind of interesting in a way to think of as Lady Gregory as a sort of proto-feminist forerunner of who Sinead O'Connor was and what she became, and in her death, the what she spoke to in the Irish culture and feeling, a great response to her death very recently. So I thought it was an appropriate connection back to the Lady Gregory story, to current Ireland, and to the whole development of Irish feminism.
And if you could say in one sentence why Lady Augusta Gregory mattered, what would you say?
She mattered because the great writing that came out of the Irish literary revival, if you think of it, arguably the greatest poet in 20th century English literature in Yeats, the greatest novelist in 20th century literature in Joyce, the greatest playwright in 20th century literature in Samuel Beckett. Finally, I think none of that would have been possible without Lady Gregory.
My guest has been Kevin Riley, and this has been the fabulous Lady Augusta Gregory in the Irish Revival. I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air, and we're going to go out on the Foggy Dew.